Hi, and welcome to this episode of TWAT Radio. I'm your host, Seal, and today we'll be talking about internet piracy, more specifically piracy in a post-Napster world. Now, it's not too hard to figure out where to begin with this show. We've all heard of the 14,000 people that have been sued by the recording industry. Now, who is this recording industry? Well, these lawsuits are in the United States, so we'll probably be talking from a more United States-centric thing. Actually, we will be talking about that, since they're pretty much the pinnacle of advancements right now when it comes to lawsuits, the recording industry, and what's going to happen there in our future for the rest of the world. And people such as me who live in up here in Canada, where it's minus 20, or so it feels like. Anyways. Okay, so the recording industry in the United States is represented by the RIAA, and that's the Recording Industry Association of America. And they were formed back in 1952 to oversee and represent the music industry. Its member labels now consist of 90% of the music recording market out there in the U.S., and they represent such large labels as Sony, EMI, Virgin, Warner Brothers, etc. Now, these guys have slapped about, 14,000 lawsuits, but not one of them has actually made itself to court. Now, the reason being is that the lawsuits are around the $3,000 settlement mark. People pay $3,000 and they have the recording industry off their backs. Now, that's just low enough for them to be, to make it unviable to seek a lawyer. Because lawyers are more expensive than that, so people choose to settle, but it's nonetheless $3,000. But that's to say that none of these guys have actually made themselves to court. That said, this is a disturbing trend, and it's been noticed, such as Judge Nancy Gertner, who stated herself that, I've never had a situation like this before, where there are powerful plaintiffs and powerful lawyers on one side, and then a whole slew of ordinary folks on the other side. That's because dozens of lawsuits had been filed in her court. Now, as for where the funds actually go out of these lawsuits, it's been, 14,000 times 3,000? So that's, 3 million in their backs? Anyways, none of that money is actually going to the artists. The recording industry president, former president, Kerry Sherman, officially stated that none of this money would go to the artists. The artists do get screwed out of this, but this is not a show about that. It's basically what I'm doing now is I'm trying to get you up to speed in a sort of my own weird little Seal way to what's going on out there. So this whole lawsuit thing, which I'm starting with that, started back in September 2003, when the recording industry started its first launch. In that case, there was 261 defendants, and they were doing this because, according to a press release, the recording industry stated that file sharing was destroying the livelihood of artists, music. Musicians, songwriters, retailers, and everyone in the music industry. And this was mirrored throughout the recording industry. File shares and file sharing was blamed as being detrimental to the industry. For example, we've got Barb Herbison, executive director of Nashville Songwriters Association International, who says, "Income has dramatically been impacted by illegal downloading. It breaks my heart that songwriters are choosing other professions because they cannot earn a living, in great part due to illegal downloading." Next up, we got Francis W. Preston, who is a president, though, of the BMI, big label out there. And he says, "Illegal downloading of music is theft, pure and simple. It robs songwriters, artists, and the industry that supports them, or the property and the livelihood. Ironically, those who steal music are stealing the future of creativity they so passionately carve. We must end this destructive cycle now." And then, finally, my last example here is Rick Kearns, president, Songwriters of Guild of America, who says, "It breaks my heart to see the great songs of American songwriters electronically shoplifted by millions every day. Like everyone else, songwriters can't make a living if we aren't paid for our hard work. And we have done all that we can to educate and warn the public rampant that internet piracy is killing our industry. So in essence, they're all saying that this file sharing thing is killing their industry. And to a certain extent, if everyone downloaded music, their model of business would not work. But this thing on piracy will actually reveal to you that the industry is not in the downturn that it was supposed to be, regardless of ethics. So yes, I'm going through my pages here of notes because I have lots of notes for this show. It actually turned out that in 2004, album sales actually increased by 10% in the first quarter of alone, and this is CD sales. Now, this is in great contrast to the recording industry, and by the recording industry, I mean synonymous with the Recording Industry Association of America, who stated that they lost 7% for the entire year. You see, the RIAA didn't actually count the amount of music records sold for these statistics, no. Instead, it counted the amount of records shipped out. Now, that makes quite the difference. For example, let's say that I ship out, let's take apples and oranges. Let's say I ship out 10 apples one day, 8 the next. Okay, I can say that my shipments went down. But if I sold 4 apples one day and 5 the next, then my sales were up, and that's exactly what was happening here. And the reason that the shipments went down is, according to this Los Angeles lawyer, because the music stores are shifting their models. Because they've got computers and better organization and everything, and they're more efficient at it, they can now actually order things in the short term, in more short term, which saves them funds in terms of shipping costs. So that's why they're doing that. So the sales were actually up. Now, ultimately, there were 147 million records sold for the first quarter of 2003, and for the first quarter of 2004, there was over 160 million. This is in the United States. Holy shit. But yeah, so it wasn't just the recording industry, though. The BPI, the British Phonographic Industry, which really emulates the recording industry in many respects, the American recording industry, also garnered record sales for 2004. In the first 12 months leading to September 2004, the BPI said that its album sales went up 3%, which represents about 7 more million albums sold. Its music DVD sales increased 41%, and even more impressive that is that in 2004, music purchased online increased by 746%. So even though the record sales are up by, 4 or 5%, these guys have DVD revenues coming in, which was zero in 1997, but now represents, I believe it's like 140 or 500 million, or anyways, a shitload of money. Okay? So we get that going on. Now, in the U.S., Nielsen SoundScan, the organization that does track the music sales in North America, tallied that for 2004, so for this upcoming year, 158 million albums were sold, sold online. So these guys, a dollar a pop, these guys are making a good amount of shit of money. Now, my concerns here have been mirrored by other people in this field. We've got Michael Geist, who's a prominent person who often appears on Slashdot on this issue. Now, you might think that I'm going off track here for a tech show, but this does all relate, and this will teach you about what's going on with piracy. There is a slight bias on my part, and I do apologize for that, but you can't help it once you do research with this stuff. Okay, so this is a bit disappointing what's going on here, mostly because the reporters didn't catch up on this. And, it's a little surprising, really, because, we here first of all, the recording industry is a business. Its bottom dollar is money, nothing else. It isn't a non-profit organization that seeks to better the world. No, these guys seek to promote the values of the labels. And what do the labels want? Money. That's all they want. So it's surprising that the reporters unquestioningly followed that. But that's normal because what they do, they take the news in, they push it out. But what's even more surprising is that, beyond them just pushing out without validating the facts, which is, I guess, normal when you have so much to do, is the fact that, they were trusting a crook. Because, the recording industry has been busted a few times in the past. Okay, downside of doing a live show is that you get interruptions like that, so, I just got interrupted there. Okay, so back to this stuff. I was basically saying that, the journalists, beyond believing that what this corporation was saying, without questioning the facts, was the fact that they were believing crooks. And I don't say this lightly. The recording industry was busted because they found that... Here's the deal. In the 80s, CDs were new technology, right? So they were quite expensive. And as time went on, well, the technology to manufacture the CDs and the manufacturing of the CDs themselves was cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But to keep the prices up, the recording, or the RIAA, artificially inflated the prices of those CDs. So they basically made CDs cost to the consumer a lot more than what they were actually worth. That's in addition to all the other profits that they were raking in. Well, they got busted, and they were supposed to dish out $143 million in compensation, $76 million of which would be CDs that would be donated by the labels to schools. Now, they sort of copped out on this, and what they ended up doing is donating, for example, 1,300 copies of Whitney Houston's rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner to some schools. Another school received, like, 73 copies of A Christmas with Yolanda Adams. So they were basically getting the 25-cent CDs that no one wanted, and this was mirrored by John Roberts, head of the Hargrove Music Library at the UC Berkeley, who put it as, "The impression one gets from the lists that the recording industry are from the lists is that the recording industry are just unloading overstock," and that's what they were doing. But that's, you know, one thing to make them fellas. Another thing is the fact that, you know, they were corrupting radio stations. Corrupting. Well, see, there's this law out there, it's called Payola, and it basically states that stations cannot be bought out for their songs on valuable airtime. What the companies that want their songs can do is they can pay the stations to put it on, and it has to be stated that these songs here are paid by Sony, EMI, whatever. But what the labels were doing is that they were actually paying DJs to air it and to basically pretend that this song was what the DJs approved of, and it was going against the Payola law. And basically corrupting, you know, stations, making them put songs that were not necessarily the best ones out there, making it disadvantageous to indie artists and so forth. So they got busted, or should I say Sony got busted over this, so did BMG, and the investigation still continues today. This is in December of 2005 by the time this airs. So it still goes on. So these guys, the recording industry, was an organization with a criminal past, and yet they were still doing all this shit, and yet the media was quoting them as if they were God, and not even questioning it, despite the fact that there were so many loud opponents to their views out there. But this wouldn't be complete if it wasn't for the fact that the media, which helped dupe people, weren't the only ones at doing so. In fact, if you go to the U.S. Senate, we've got Orrin Hatch, oh yes, my favorite senator out there. He was appointed in March 2005 to be the senator in charge of a newly established panel on copyrights, patents, and trademarks. Now, the panel is designated to be the authoritative voice in the American government on the issue of file sharing and piracy. And guess what? He was paid $183,000 by the entertainment industries, and that means the music, movie, and television industries, for the 2000 to 2004 period. Now, this is contrary to other countries such as Canada, which rely on, or which have a maximum of $1,000 that can be donated to politicians. But if you pay anyone $183,000, odds are they'll be slightly biased. And, so we got ourselves, essentially, a bribed Senate into power. Not only that, but one who's in charge of file sharing. And where this all comes in, the media, the senators, the fact that laws would come to pass, laws would continue to exist because of this misinformed populace, because they don't have enough time to do all the research into file sharing. They've got a bunch of issues on their plates, right? And among the laws that would be passed by the Senate would be the DMCA, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And it was passed in 1998, although it was discussed through and through with the WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, back in 1996. Now, in 1998, when it was passed, it was on the heels of the NET Act, that's the No Electronic Theft Act of 1997. And what the NET Act said is that, basically, sharing stuff not for profit is illegal, because beforehand, it was legal. And in fact, if you watch Jason Scott's wonderful documentary, the BBS documentary, you'll see a scene there where this guy got supposedly busted for piracy, but they couldn't do anything because it wasn't actually illegal. So we got that. And what the DMCA states is that, well, it's composed of a few acts, namely that it's illegal to tamper with digital restrictions on purchased products, and that's Title 1, Section 1201 of the industry. Again, another interruption. Okay, so off we go again. Don't you just love telemarketers? Anyways, back to this. So, we got this one title, and then we got Title 2, Section 202, which states that anyone carrying objectionable content is legally liable to be sued unless the materials are removed. And by anyone carrying, I mean doing over a network. Then there was other stuff that was passed with this, namely a thing for, what was it? Oh yeah, ship hulls. Ship hulls could now be copyrighted, and that was passed through. And that's yay, but the other two aren't yay. So, the recording industry supported the propagation of the DMCA and for it to continue to exist to this day. But they weren't the only ones. We've also got the MPAA, and that's the Movie Picture Association of America, which was founded back in 1922 to, likewise to the recording industry, represent the industry, the film industry. So, that's that. And as with the recording industry, the film industry had begun their own war on file sharing, and ultimately, as it would turn out, entire technology is fair use and free speech. But much like the music industry, the MPAA had begun to sue individuals. And much like the music industry, it would sue the mass, or it would use the mass media misinformation to further its agenda. Now, in 2004, July of 2004, OTX, which stands for the Online Testing Exchange, which is a research firm, was released a study for the MPAA, which the MPAA later used in the press releases. And this basically stated that 1 in 4 internet users had illegally downloaded a movie, pirated a movie, so forth. Now, this spawned the MPAA used those figures to estimate how much money it lost because of this piracy. And headlines came out, you know, movie downloading costs MPAA billions. And I think that was the, oh, anyway, some Australian newspaper that passed with this one. And there's like a bunch here, but I'll skip those. So anyways, if you actually look at the figures, you'll notice that they're extremely flawed. In the fine print, you also realize that it's 1 out of 4 broadband users. Now, that's a little misleading on itself, but you know what? Broadband users, there's still a shitload of dial-up users out there. But that doesn't matter, because that's nothing compared to what's coming up. What OTX measured wasn't actually the amount of people that downloaded pirated movies. What they measured is people downloading movies, period. That includes trailers. If you went to apple.com/trailers and watched a movie there, according to the MPAA, you were pirating a movie. And they counted that as a $12 loss, or more. I forgot how much they were counting it. But they were counting it as real losses. If you had a digital camera and took a little video of your daughter, whatever, that was a pirated movie. Especially if you distributed it over the internet. Think how many millions was lost that way. So the figures were highly flawed, and yet they're still used today, those very figures, to account for all the piracy that's going on and for the MPAA's woes. And the study also said that, what was it, of the people who downloaded movies, 17% of them decreased their theater of attendance, or their attendance to theaters. Of course, they didn't talk about the other 83%. And as it turned out, 41% of people actually increased their attendance thanks to file sharing. Probably because, who knows why. Anyways, this is not my job, I'm just relaying the stats, right? In fact, the BBC was reporting that an overall increase in box office by 5% in 2004. And according to Adams Media Research, the industries as a whole had seen a 27% rise in profits over the 4 preceding years. So these guys are not doing the downslope and loss in billions like they're claiming. But the MPAA was still spreading out their false stats. And you know what? They did one up. Instead of just targeting adults, they would now do kids. Now these guys in 2003 launched the What's the Diff campaign. No, wait, I should say this in a rap gangster style. What's the Diff campaign, bitch? I sound like a fucking Russian gangster. Anyways, no offense to all Russian gangsters. And Dan, sorry about that. Anyways, oh god. Don't hurt me. So yeah, the MPAA launched, no, please, its campaign in 2003. And it spent $200,000 doing so. And what it did is it paid this group of volunteers. I don't have their exact name in their my notes, but they paid them. They went to across a bunch of schools across the United States, and they would get students to engage in skits such as, you know, playing the film producer and the starving artist, and they'd have to say lines like, "Illegal file flapping has turned my dreams into nightmares," and, "When people illegally download my hand, they are stealing from my family and me." So students were brainwashed with the program's motto, "If you don't pay, you've stolen it." Now, of course, the program neglected to tell them that 46% of artists actually approved of file sharing, or how more and more artists were placing their music on the internet free for others to download and support their bands. And in fact, if you go to magnetune.com or Internet Archives, that's all that is. Now, nor did it tell them about how copyrights expire or how it's okay under the Fair Use and Fair Dealings doctrines. Fair Dealings is the Canadian version, Fair Use is the American version, to freely distribute copyright materials for the purpose of parody, review, critique, education, or research. Nope, the industry wanted to spread its slanted corporate view on copyrights and wanted to teach that to kids. Now, teachers were also encouraged to take part because their kids could write essays, and if the essay won, the teachers got some sweet-ass prizes. Now, as Melinda Anderson, spokeswoman for the National Education Association, put it, "It's inappropriate to offer tips, gifts, or prizes in exchange for adults pushing a commercial agenda in a classroom. It speaks to a new era of commercialism in classrooms. And you know what? MPA, it's again a business. And likewise, it's like Coke going into a school and saying, you know what? Fuck Pepsi. Eat our shit. And make essays about it. We'll give you prizes." Anyways, so the kids were being brainwashed by the industry, but that was new. Disney, who is a big member of the MPAA, also released quite a few shows in the past, including one from the Proud Family, where they basically bash file sharing, and characters are engaged in this, engaged in file sharing, that is, download music, get busted, blah blah blah, they're screwed. And I believe South Park has a parody of this as well. So we got that. So what else? Yeah, so, you know, it's surprising that these guys were able to get their agenda across so clearly and through the medias like this. And it's not like these people were being served by the laws that were being passed. I mean, if you look at the DMCA, I'm not saying that the RIA pushed the DMCA, but they're really keeping it up there. You've got instances, you know, it's illegal to import anime DVDs. It's illegal to import foreign DVDs if they're region encoded for their region in here, because, you know what, playing it usurps the code or the protection on there, and region-free players are under legal question, and blah, 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 blah. It's illegal to play DVDs on your Linux machine. Hoo-ah, that's genius, right? Because the DCSS code is illegal, and that's the thing that is used to, de-encode movies, or to, render movies. Not render, but you know what I mean. Remove the encoding there that's protecting its content. Protecting, loosely termed, use, right? Or, I could also go on to why iTunes users aren't being served with this. I mean, you've got a fact here that you've got an internet service online, but you can't take the songs to you bought to put it on another MP3 device other than friggin' iPods. You buy the music, you just spent, you know, like $10 supporting your favorite band, let's say U2, and yet it's illegal for you to convert that music to a format you can actually listen to on your music player? These laws, like the DMCA, they're not there to benefit the people, and hey, if you have examples of it benefiting people, by all means share it with me. But they're more meant to benefit corporations. And you know what? It's true, because I can't see people being, you know, really all benefiting that from file protection technologies, especially since... Or, I mean, like, especially since that if you're, you know, circumventing it and it's only violating the DMCA and not privacy of people, well, then what you're breaking is really not... it's not someone's stuff. It's access to content that you really purchased, you know? Anyways, but this, you know, isn't the worst they've done thanks to the DMCA. I mean, and they went after file sharing, and you know what, you can have your stance there, that's fine, but if you look at Nutella Network, there was a study that was released joint with the California State University and Chinese University, and the top 15 searches, or 80% of the top 15 searches on the Nutella peer-to-peer network in 2003 were actually for legitimate shit. There was three, which were something that was really not good, but the rest were open source and whatever. So, technologies themselves are neutral, and yet, you know, they got litigated. And one example of this is Kazaa. Now, Kazaa is owned by Sharman Networks. For the hackers out there, Sharman Networks did not develop Kazaa. It was actually developed by another group, but was bought out by Sharman Networks. I'm sorry about this. But, so Sharman Networks got sued the shit out of it in Australia, was going to get sued in the US, only they moved their corporate headquarters to a country named Vanuatu, and so they were in deep shit over in Australia. Now, they said that their program was essentially like a VCR, and that once it was released, you know, they had no control of it, and it can be used for good and bad, and that harkens back to the overused 1984 Betamax court case, in which the Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled that Sony would not be responsible for the illegitimate copying of movies that could be made with its video cassette recorders. But nonetheless, they got fucked, and they were ordered to pay $90 million in damages, and basically they lost their case, right? But you have to understand how these networks work, and I'll get to that in a few seconds. Meanwhile, another legal confrontation was brewing in the United States. We got MGM versus Grokster, like, as it came to be known, and it's a case that pitched 28 of the world's largest entertainment companies against two of the most prominent file-sharing programs out there, namely Grokster and Morpheus. Now, you have to understand how these programs work. Okay, it's on the basis of nodes and supernodes, for the fast track protocol, which is what Grokster uses. Basically, how that works is that your computer is considered a node. That's the one with a client on it. It'll connect to a supernode. Okay? So you can, and how it does so is it might have a list of IP addresses for supernodes, whatever. There are other techniques for bootstrapping extra supernodes lists onto your computer. But anyways, you've got supernodes there, and then it'll take the supernode that's there, it'll ask for a list of other supernodes, it'll connect to them, so now your computer is connected to a number of supernodes. And then it sends to one of those supernodes a list of files it has. Now let's say you're looking for something, well, you send your request to the supernode, it queries other supernodes, it sends back the result to you, and then let's say you've got computer A which has the file, then you'll directly connect to computer A to do the transaction. So, in other words, the network... the developer that oversees, that develops, that makes, that codes the network actually has no control over it because they don't actually have any input on it. Now, you might have heard about Kazaa submitting logs. Yeah, if you're a Kazaa user, your logs of what you were doing were submitted to Kazaa Corporation. But again, the companies that did so did not have any involvement into the workings of the program. That's more of a spyware, you know, side of the program. And then there's other networks out there. I mean, there's Morpheus, and Morpheus uses the Nutella protocol, which I consider to be a bit more archaic than the Fast Track protocol. And the Nutella protocol has no supernodes. Basically, your computer will, again, have a list of IPs to connect, and it can get them from IRC chat rooms, whatever. And so it'll connect to a bunch of computers directly. Those computers will relay back to your computer, more computers, you connect to a bunch of computers, and then when you're looking for something, you send off your request to each one of those computers. In turn, those computers pass the request on, and those computers pass it on, and it gets passed on, until someone says, yeah, I have it, and then we'll either directly connect to you to say that it has it, or relay back the message through the computers that you sent it off to. The downside with this, of course, is that your computer becomes just loaded with requests, slows down the network, and that's why I don't like it so much. But anyways, not that I ever used it, of course. Not that I ever use any network. Anyways, so we got that. And but these guys got sued, and, you know, they were... It's pretty much, they were arguing same thing as Kazaa. They're like pen manufacturers that have, you know, once the pen is sold, they don't have control on how it's used. Now, these guys lost in March 2005 the court case, and they were ordered to pay restitution, which came out, where is it? Oh, I don't have the figures. But anyways, they were paid, had to pay restitution. And the reason that these guys were declared illegal was because of the motivation behind what they were doing. Of course, motivation isn't exactly apparent if you visit the old sites of Morpheus and Grokster on the Internet Wayback Machine, but that doesn't matter. And fresh news off November, which 7th, which is just 2 days from the recording of this show, Grokster replaced its homepage with something that says, you know, file sharing is illegal. So we got that. Now, you got big corporations there, and if they get sued, well, some people are okay with it. It's okay, you know, it's true that there was some questions of morality there. But then you've got other cases such as Danielle Peng and Jesse Jordan. And they were two American university students at Princeton University in Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And if you work there and are listening to this show, forgive me, I don't know how to say it. But anyways, despite each attending separate institutions, they shared a common bond. They had both developed independently a search engine that searched their campus networks. Now, this search engine used the Microsoft protocol for file sharing, SMB, I think it is. Anyways, so they used the Microsoft network to find files. It was already available to them. The search engine made no distinction between any kind of file. It could search for anything off the networks of anyone else. So the people could search for photographs and audio files, and you know, it solved a long-standing dilemma. All these computers were hooked up, all these files were shared, but how can you find the specific file you need through 3,000 accounts? That solved that issue. This is really different. You know, you can't argue the motivation with this one. Nonetheless, though, they were sued by the recording industry. They couldn't afford to mount a proper defense, and so they both, again, settled. This time, though, for $12,000 and $15,000, respectively. These guys were FUBAR'd. And Jesse Jordan has recouped the money through donations, but Peng is still $4,000 short, and because this occurred a few years ago. Now, students like that were not the only ones to... You know, like, oh man, that's bad enough, right? Being sued for making a search engine, which is exactly what this was. I mean, you can debate the ethics of Morpheus and Grokster, but you can't debate this. Anyways, whatever. Because it could, you know, their search engine could search for MP3s as well as photographs and whatever, they were shut down, and fuck. Anyways, wow, there's lots of swearing in this show. Just blame it on my French. And so you got the recording industry doing that, and not only that, but they were also threatening researchers that were conducting any research into the inner workings of the protection systems. One case is the SDMI challenge that occurred in 2000, in which Professor Edward Faltson was able to crack the encryption of the SDMI. And the SDMI is an organization out there that was set out to make, to protect music formats, and again, protect is such a loose term here. More like molest music formats, right? And he responded to what was called the SDMI challenge, and that basically stated that break our encryption, we want you to submit the results, and that's that. Now, what he did is that he broke the encryption indeed, but he was going to release his research to everyone, not just the SDMI. And he was going to do so at the 4th International Information Hiding Workshops in April of 2004. 2 weeks before doing so, though, he received a letter from the RIAA, and as did the organization of that workshop, and they were both threatening to be sued if this research got out. So, end result, he did not release the research. And likewise, because of this, the IEEE required authors for a little while to say to not indemnify, or what it is. Anyways, to basically say that the IEEE is not at all responsible if the people that submit articles to them are sued in any way because of the DMCA and because the content they do goes against whatever the recording industry or any other industry may feel like. And, so that's, you know, what's going on with the DMCA. It's not exactly going on the best of use. Again, if you can think of a single good use of it, please, pray tell. But, yeah. I mean, there are some instances where you can use the DMCA to, that's DRM. So, no, fuck it. DMCA, pray tell. So we got the recording industry there. We've also got the MPAA supporting these laws that basically fuck people over. And then we also have the BSA. Now, the BSA is the Business Software Alliance, and they have a presence in over 80 countries, and they're represented by such companies as Microsoft, Apple, HP, Dell, Cisco, and Symantec. And like the RIAA and MPAA before it, they issued press releases saying that the software industry was being fucked, absolutely raped, by software piracy. And it did so using research from the International Data Corporation, which is a research firm, obviously. And what they found is that $33 billion in losses due to piracy were caused in 2004. Now, you have to look at the stats again, and you'll notice that they're extremely flawed. And thank God, The Economist did that for me. The Economist being that prominent magazine. So not just anyone saying this. The fucking Economist. Hoo-ah. Anyways, they said, basically, that the figures were flawed, and it all has to do with the reason, or the way these figures were calculated. These guys took a country, let's say Vietnam. They said, okay, we sell this much to that country, there's this much software installed, minus one from the other, and this is how much we're losing. Now, the actual figures of how much software was installed on computers was a really rough estimate in some cases. It wasn't based on hard factual data at all, in fact, for any country, but so it wasn't really based on any hard data. But not only that, I mean, you've got the issue that every software installed that's pirated was counted as a loss in monetary, you know, figures, loss in revenues. Well, you gotta figure that that's not exactly how things work out there. For instance, Vietnam, which was responsible for much of the piracy, with a piracy rate of 90%, according to these guys, 92%, sorry. Well, the average income there for a year is $480. Their yearly income is less than what it costs to buy the non-molested version of Microsoft Office. What the fuck? These guys, if they couldn't pirate, they wouldn't have the software anyways. Plus, it didn't count open source, but open source, face it, sort of a minority, especially in when you have the pirated version of some popular software available. And same deal with fucking China, fucking everywhere. Not that I say fuck China, because I love China. Please don't kill me. Anyways, so we got that. And if you actually look at what these companies of the BSA make, their revenues increase by a solid amount each year. Okay? Adobe, actually, Microsoft, grew up 6%. I didn't write down the figures for Adobe, which is why I'm going over it, but I did write down that it went up, as did Symantec and other members. And as Gary Shapiro, head of the Consumer Electronic Association, put it, the BSA's figures were absurd on its face and patently obscene. But nevertheless, the BSA did its own campaign to spread its message, and again, try to target children this time round. And they launched what's called the Cyber Ethics Champion Code, in which they spread their very one-sided view of copyrights to children, especially with respect to piracy. Of course, this got some people concerned, especially the American Library Association, who in 2004 had to launch their own campaign to teach kids a more balanced view of copyrights. Because, basically, these corporations were lying to kids about what was going on to copyrights. Lying while misinforming, same deal. Especially when it comes to kids that assume that the misinformation is true. So, we want, Melinda Anderson, a spokeswoman for the NEA, the National Education Association in the United States, put it, we want to teach children to be thinking human beings, not parrot, for some corporate agenda. So, the BSA was the third biggest supporter of that, and with that, we got DMCA passed, and there's other examples of abuse of the DMCA. I mean, we've got Google, which regularly censors its materials. In fact, they get 30 requests a month for that. And that ranges from the Church of Scientology demanding that Google block 126 anti-Scientology sites to people demanding to take down blogs because the photos that are being used of politicians there are copyrighted. To swaths of blogs, again, quoting copyrighted press releases. And all these things are, of course, not exactly copyright infringement, but they do get taken down nonetheless. So we've got that. We've got the fact, again, we've got, other interesting cases of abuse. I mean, we've got Copyleft, which sold t-shirts with a DCSS code on it. And basically, you know, their t-shirt, it was to support the whole 2600 versus MPAA case, which that's where this CSS code was ruled really illegal. And so they put it on the t-shirt. But because they had this code on a t-shirt, they were sued. And so that was interesting, but thank God the people suing them lost them. And there's other cases. We've got the Lexmark case. We've got the Aibo Pet. Someone basically reverse-engineered the Aibo code or the software that runs on Aibos and was able to make the dog do stuff like play piano. He didn't release any of the code. His things were binaries, just making use of that knowledge. But because he made use of that knowledge, he was taken down. So we've got all these cases, and that's basically what's been going on in this post-Napster era. In terms of future, we've got more cases going on. We've got the DMCA, which just finished off its own review. It was scheduled for review. We've got all these people pushing their own agenda. And the thing to remember about this is, never trust the media. Just, if something sounds off, do your own research, learn from this. With that, I do conclude this show. This has been Seal. You can contact me at iseal@gnook.org. That's iseal@gnook.org. I can't say it either. I'd like to thank Droops here for letting me on and do this. And this has been a presentation on TWAT Radio, community-based radio. And if you have some stuff you feel is techie or whatever and you want to share it, by all means, get in touch with Droops. He's an awesome guy. And yeah. So with that, I do conclude the show. The music that you've been listening to, by the way, is a guy named Aaron Starks. His album, Lines Build Walls, I can't think right now. Anyways, you can get it off of magnatune.com. It's all Creative Commons stuff, free for non-profit redistribution. So with that, I wish you a wonderful day, night, whatever. And this has been, again, Seal, signing off.